A message for you podcast and web listeners. I do this show because KPFA broadcasts it. Despite all the technological advances of recent years, terrestrial radio still provides legitimacy and reach, and I wouldn't keep doing this show without KPFA. Besides, KPFA is a great institution that badly needs your support. They're fundraising for the next few weeks, and this show is based on one of those fundraising efforts. To make room for the fundraising, I only broadcast about two-thirds of this interview on KPFA. Web and podcast listeners are getting the whole thing. If you can, please support KPFA and mention Behind the News if you do. You can get Corey Robbins' book, The Reactionary Mind, for a pledge of $80. If that's too much or not to your taste, any other amount is welcome. Please call 510-848-5732 or visit kpfa.org and donate some cash if you'd like to keep these shows coming. And thanks as always for listening. Now on to the show. Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Today, a long chat with a single guest, Corey Robin, Associate Professor of Political Science at Brooklyn College and author of The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Sarah Palin, just out in paperback from Oxford University Press. Long ago and sort of far away, I was a teenage reactionary. I'd begun my rightward move late in high school, and by the time I got to college, I was a full-blown movement conservative. I joined the Party of the Right, one of the constituent organizations of the Yale Political Union, founded in the 1950s at about the same time William F. Buckley founded National Review. When I joined the POR in the early 1970s, the ranks were thin and the cause seemed lost, a romantic but ultimately futile battle against the New Deal, the Great Society, and the statist war on liberty. We had no idea that a decade later, movement conservatism would triumph in Britain and the U.S., with Thatcher and Reagan, who were, despite being politicians, ideologically sound from the right-wing point of view. And Reagan and Thatcher would help transform policies and discourse, not only their home countries, but around the world. My conservatism didn't last, but I'm grateful for the experience. It gave me insight into how these people think, something about which most folks on the left haven't a clue. But given the power of the right, that's a serious omission, which is why Corey Robin is so important. Unlike me, Corey never had any experience on the right, but he's immersed himself in their literature and emerged to tell the tale. I spoke with him in October 2011 when his book, The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Sarah Palin, first came out in hardcover, and now it's out in paperback from Oxford University Press. Corey Robin has a major essay on the Nietzschean cast of economists like Jevons and the notorious Friedrich Hayek, who find warrior-like heroism in the capitalist class. His essay will be the May 27 issue of The Nation, and it's now on The Nation's website, thenation.com. Corey Robin. It's been about 6 or 7 months since we talked last. And any reaction to the reception to the book? Anything you've rethought as a result of people have said or written about it?
Well, I think the one thing, and in fact it came up in our interview about this, is where does libertarianism fit within the conservative tradition? And this was something that came up, I think you were the first actually to raise it to me of my readers, and it came up an awful lot on blogs and in conversation, and I had an answer at the time, but I would say it was a very provisional one, and since then it's actually ballooned into my next book project.
Which is?
It's a political theory, cultural history of the free market from the French Revolution forward. And I've really had to dive into these texts and Hayek and von Mises, Schumpeter, also reading a lot of stuff from the 19th century as well. And so I would say that was the, I wouldn't say it's the weakest part of the book, but it was the most underdeveloped part of the book that, out of discussion with various people, I've really begun to think about a lot more.
Yeah, let's get to that when we talk about Nietzsche and Hayek and those guys. But it's funny that I think most economists don't read those things anymore.
They don't.
They just read short papers with a lot of math in them.
Exactly.
So you're doing something that the actual practitioners uh, are very often unaware of. Someone told me a story of running into Joe Stiglitz at a conference years ago and saying, you know, your ideas about adverse selection were anticipated by Smith and Ricardo. And he said, really? So, this guy, you know, Nobel Prize, one of the leading lights of the field, and he hasn't read the classics of political economy. In the conclusion to The Reactionary Mind, you note that you wonder if the Tea Party had revived the right. We are now a couple of years later. What do you think?
Well, I mean, the point of that conclusion was to say, regardless of what the Tea Party was or wasn't going to do, was that conservatism was really on a long-term downward trajectory. And my argument was basically that it was because it had been so successful. It had obviously conquered the Republican Party, and it had now conquered the Democratic Party over a long period. It's basic fundamental principles. So if you take seriously the idea that conservatism is a reactionary politics, once it has succeeded in its reaction, it really doesn't have much more it can do. And I think, in a sense, it turned out to be right. I had thought the Tea Party might have a longer lifespan, but it turned out to have a much shorter lifespan. And in part, I think it's because this kind of politics, although it can continue to govern in the bureaucracy and in the institutions and in the media, it doesn't have the same revolutionary quality that it once had, not because it was contained, but because it succeeded.
And of course, this helps explain why the right has invented such demented fantasies about Obama, the Kenyan socialist.
Yeah, I mean, which is really, you know, when you think about it, like all the rhetoric of the right about Obama, not only is it not, you know, accurate, it's telling, though, that it has to resort to a vocabulary that is so old of, you know, socialism and communism. I mean, the one thing is the Muslim thing that has a something of a resonance today. But those other words don't really have much of a resonance anymore. And if you think back, again, to the long arc of the conservative movement in the 20th century, when McCarthy called liberal socialists, not only was there real socialism that it could refer to, really existing socialism, but there was an alliance that had existed between liberals and left liberals in the 30s and 40s that was of recent memory, and there were policies that came out of that. And so it had some kind of political purchase. And, you know, today when they use those terms, it has no political purchase at all, except in a very small slice of the electorate. And I think we're seeing that now in the diminishing returns of those elections.
Of course, the great Muslim conspiracy seems to serve as a substitute.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that as I said, that's the one. I think that word has some kind of resonance today, but you know, it's even probably further removed from reality.
One recurring theme of the right, which you write about, is the need to play the victim, playing the plebe. Why is that so important in right-wing thought?
Well, the task of the right has always been to try to reverse these progressive advances from the left. From the very beginning, that has been its task. But it has had to do it in the context. It has had to try to push back against these democratic progressive advances in a context where the masses are mobilized, where this is not a strictly aristocratic politics, you know, from the 16th century, where the people aren't active. The people are active. They've been activated. And you can't just put them back in a box. So one of the things that the right has had to do is to try to figure out a way of defending privilege, defending inequality, in a context where you have people who are on the bottom, who aren't necessarily benefiting from that inequality. And the victim talk, and in the book I say, you know, Edmund Burke, I think, is the real pioneer here when he talks about Marie Antoinette being dragged from the palace at Versailles. She's the first aristocratic victim. That kind of talk is very important for the right and as a way of winning support from people who are at the bottom. Everybody is in some sense a victim. And I don't know if I say this in the book, but one of the things I came to in the writing of it was that victim talk or victimology is the right's universal language. It's their alternative universalism because it appeals across the board. Everybody can imagine themselves to be a victim. Everybody has suffered some kind of loss. And it's a way of creating sympathetic identification across very different types of people.
Yes, you mentioned loss, and the loss is also the experience of loss and complaining about it is an important part of the right-wing discourse.
Huge. I mean, and it's not when the right is at its most potent, it's not a fake language. when the right is at its most potent, it is either under threat of dispossession or it has been dispossessed. And those are real forms of loss. And I think this is one of the things that the left sometimes does not, or more recently the left, I should say, that's gotten squishier about this issue. The task of the left is to dispossess people of their privileges. And when it is doing that, the right will then start speaking about loss, and it will be those losses are real. I mean, you know, it doesn't matter if they were unfairly gotten, those gains. It doesn't matter if it's unjust that they have them in the first place. They're losing them, and those are genuinely real losses.
Yeah, well, as you say, the left, though, has not really been talking much about dispossession, expropriation, or any of those things. It's gotten very mild. Yeah, no, what the right gets exercised now are things like Ben Bernanke is too easy with the money and there's too much deficit spending going on. They feel expropriated by, you know, what Ben Bernanke is doing, which is insane.
Yeah, I think that's, again, it's a sign of that the language has really gotten unhinged from the reality. And I just don't know how much traction they can really get over the long term with that kind of thing.
Although the Ronte class is disturbed that 1% interest rates are nothing you can live on. So they are being expropriated in that way.
That's true. Let me just say one thing about that. I mean, there are lots of ways to expropriate the expropriators. What the right is, I think, historically most concerned about is when it's a very overt political mass movement. These other kinds of things behind the scenes don't galvanize their attention, I think, nearly to the degree that a real mass movement that's actually mobilized and doing these things in a very public, not in a technocratic, quiet, behind-the-scenes way. And that's what's really interesting is that, you know, the right gets fixated on these kinds of much more public, overt forms of expropriation and sometimes can actually ignore the other things that are happening behind the scenes that are in the long term probably far more corrosive to their power and privilege.
Such as?
Well, you know, things like what you're talking about with certain kinds of interest rates and things, that kind of, I mean, this is much more your territory than it is mine. Like, for instance, if you go back to the 30s, you know, and you read the debates, you know, the thing that the right was most upset about was the Wagner Act and all the labor legislation and in the workplace of the New Deal. Other things didn't get as much attention and traction for them. And because I think it was something that was just very much in their face and right up front for them. And not that it wasn't real, but it was just much more dramatic to them.
Speaking with Corey Robin, whose book, The Reactionary Mind, is just out in paperback from Oxford. You actually touch on something which is where I was about to go, which is the importance of private power. You mentioned, of course, the New Deal legislation that made it easier for unions to do their work. But, you know, most people think of politics as things that revolve around the state. But you write about issues of private power, the boss in the workplace, the patriarch in the family. So, how does that figure into the structure of conservative thought?
Well, I mean, I think it's absolutely critical. And I think this is something that a lot of people have missed in looking at conservatism, is that they've always been attuned to forms of power that most closely approximate the kind of power that a feudal lord had in the Middle Ages. Personal, concrete, the power of command, really. The power to tell another human being how to dispose of his or her body and mind at any given moment in time. And this is not, I try to stress this, this is not abstract power. This is not symbolic domination. This is viscerally and tangibly understood as the power to command another being to do your will.
Get my coffee at home or in the office.
Exactly. And, you know, if you have to dig around a bit, but once you do, you start seeing that this has been very, very clear. And I think it begins to explain, for instance, some of the alliances that the right has managed to cobble together over the years. So, for instance, between more libertarian-ish, free market-oriented thinkers who seem to have zero interest in family values or that kind of cultural politics, that alliance between them and the more family values, cultural politics-oriented people who are concerned about the family. And, you know, for many years that was thought to be a kind of provisional alliance of convenience. I actually think there's something deeper that's going on there, and it has to do with understanding the private realm. You know, what's conventionally called the private realm. I mean, the left doesn't see this as private at all. But in the family and in the workplace, where you have an opportunity to exercise that kind of power, untrammeled by the state.
So this is the resonance of the cultural issues, which a lot of people on the left don't quite understand or dismiss as some sort of holdover from more primitive days, is actually a very live issue.
I think it's, you know, I think it's absolutely central. I mean, historians, of course, of the right have really honed in on the centrality of gender politics to the rise, to the success of the right. You could think of the rise of the modern, the 20th century right in three waves. It starts in the reaction against the New Deal, and that is at its center. It gains traction in the reaction over the black freedom movements, which, again, were very personal and very tangible. I mean, James Baldwin has some wonderful essays where he talks about the kind of power white people had over black people. It wasn't just symbolic politics. It wasn't just something that was far away. It was very close, and particularly in places like the South, very close.
No, when I was living in Virginia in the mid-70s, older black people would stand aside when a white person was walked down the sidewalk.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's...
It was stunning to me as a Yankee. I've never experienced anything like it.
Yeah. I mean, and that those things are... I think people, you know, dismiss that as symbolism, but it's not. It's about one's standing in society.
Well, it's engraved into your body.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very... It's
on
exactly
both sides of the relationship.
Exactly. It's a very physical gesture of obeisance and of regard. So, you know, I think that's the second. But, of course, the thing that really, I think, put the right over the top was the gender issue and the feminist movement. And, you know, because they finally were able to tap into a whole cohort of people, both men and women, who were touched by this revolution that was happening that was very, you know, fundamentally transformative in the private domestic space.
As I was looking over the book again this morning, I noted there's a bit about Phyllis Schlafly initially not opposing the ERA or thinking it was kind of harmless.
No, I mean, I think a lot of people, I think even, I mean, certainly Nixon and people like that supported it, but I think even people like Strom, I mean, I'd have to go back. It was an essay by Bethany Morton, I think, that I first discovered this, or I think it was Bethany Morton, it might have been somebody else, but the historian at the University of Georgia. But a lot of people just thought it just didn't, you know, of course it had been a longstanding Republican cause going back for decades, and they didn't really think twice about it. And then...
What changed?
Well, I think partially the feminist movement changed. I mean, the feminist movement began to make the personal political, and started agitating in all spheres, in the workplace and in the family in particular, and wanting to change the gender division of labor. And all of a sudden, that what seemed like this incredibly anodyne language of constitutionalism acquired a meaning that was probably much closer to its reality, that these ideas about equality really are very explosive ideas.
And it came down to the unisex bathroom and nonsense like that.
Yeah, yeah. But again, it gets back to this issue we were just talking about, these very physical relationships that I think really do, they do really matter a tremendous amount.
And do you think people on the left adequately understand this?
I don't. I think that private dimension of power is something, liberals certainly don't understand this. I mean, I think they think that you can do these sorts of, make these changes, and somehow or another, the reason of their arguments or whatever, it'll just happen. Or if they understand the resistance to it, it's resistance on the Republican side of the House and of Representatives. They don't understand this social metabolism that's out there, this chemistry that's put into motion, and these reactions. So I don't think liberals understand it. And honestly, I don't think the left really understands it all that well. I mean, I think, you know, people who are really who are real trade unionists understand it because it's experienced every day. But of course, there aren't that many of them left, and they're not all doing their jobs right. But it's hard for me to think of what precincts of the left are really getting it today.
Yeah, well, there's a tendency on a lot of the left to look at the cultural issues, as they sort of, you know, put it in quotes, as a distraction from real politics. But it is real politics.
It is, yeah. I mean, it's dominated our, I mean, how could it, it's dominated our politics for so many, I mean, at the level of high politics, it's, I mean, the ERA, that was a That was a huge political battle. That wasn't just something that happened in, you know, women's studies seminars. I mean, it was debated in the halls of Congress, oh, in every state house. I mean, it doesn't get much more political than, I mean, again, even if you want to take the most conventional definition of it. And it helped put a president into the White House.
Yeah, well, the political scientist Jenny Mansbridge actually commissioned a poll that found that something, I can't remember the exact number, but 70 or 80% of American women had called a man a male chauvinist pig.
Really?
So, you know, it got to that point.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's oral histories that have been done, but I think if, you know, it's interesting, you know, just to talk to people who were even children at the time. You know, my sister was actually a soccer player. And, you know, I grew up in Westchester suburb, and my family was not at all political. And my sister was very good at playing soccer, and she got into the girls' team, and it was crappy. Title IX hadn't really gone through. This is 1978, 79. I mean, Title IX was on the books, but it hadn't been really implemented. Actually, it was probably a little bit earlier, 77, 78. So she then decided she wanted to be on the boys' team. And this became eventually a huge court case. It was on the front page of the New York Times. And this is just...
Oh, is it your sister?
Yeah, that was my sister.
The family of troublemakers.
Well, but that was the point. We weren't at
right.
all. My father worked for IBM, you know? But that's what the feminist movement did. And then I remember, I mean, I was in sixth grade and seventh grade and getting into arguments with kids on the bus. Can girls play soccer as good as boys? You know, and that's what that movement, I mean, these are just kids in school, and they're fighting about this. And, I mean, again, we weren't a political family at all.
Yeah, I noticed yesterday we just went to a track and field meet that our kid was in. It's a New York Roadrunners sponsor for children. And it was about 50% girls,
yeah.
Girls running. And, you know, I was just thinking back, that just did not exist, even when you were younger, right?
No, I mean, this was, like I said, this was 1978. I'd have to... look, to remember the exact dates, but yeah, it was not.
But, you know, the right has lost that one. But have they given up fighting it?
Well, they haven't. I mean, on certain things, like reproductive rights, I don't think they've lost it. I mean, you know, I can't remember. It was not so long ago. It was in Slate or somewhere. I mean, just the number of states where it's almost impossible to get an abortion now.
Oh, yeah, like the huge percentage
it's
of
huge.
Counties.
It's counties, huge. In counties.
Yeah.
And, you know, it seemed to have subsided, but there was that period leading up until the 2012 election in the spring of 2012 where, I mean, it wasn't just abortion. We were talking about birth control was really on the table. And there was all that legislation that in fact, a lot of Tea Party Republican parties were pushing at the state level. In fact, Mike Consell did a great little study showing the correlation between the states that were pushing birth control legislation and anti-union legislation, stripping public sector workers, I mean, a whole bunch of different types. And it was almost one-to-one. The states where a Tea Party-dominated Republican Party had taken power, those were the two fronts, those were the two critical fronts that they were pushing on.
It's a war in mastery in both senses.
Exactly.
I'm speaking with Corey Robin, author of The Reactionary Mind, just out in paperback from Oxford University Press. George Gilder writes luridly about... contraception and abortion, and what it means for someone like him. It would mean like the ceding of male control over sex and reproduction to women.
Mm-hmm.
And so they take this, and it's interesting. Gilder is one of those people who is both, you know, the libertarian on economic issues, but a total authoritarian.
Yeah.
A male authoritarian in the household.
Yeah, and he was hugely influential. That's the other thing that people forget. Like you read him now, and he sounds insane. Those books from the 80s.
Men and Marriage.
Yeah.
That was a nutty book.
It was. I mean, it's a great book to teach. He sounds insane, but, you know, he was
really onto something.
Well, but he was their real public intellectual.
Yeah.
You know, he was not an extreme figure by any stretch. He's actually quite a good person to teach because he brings those two things together. I mean, Charles Murray is another one as well. But I do think that on the issue of... I think this is something, you know, especially male leftists, you know, they poo-poo the whole question of reproductive rights, but it's pretty fundamental. I mean, again, at this level of controlling sexuality, controlling the body.
Well, yeah, Tom Frank made a career out of treating this as some sort of bait and switch where the right uses cultural issues to get people to vote against their economic interests, but
right.
he's all wrong with that.
Yeah, I mean, I just think there's no bait and switch. I mean, they take it seriously, and they actually have pursued those cultural issues. It's hard to overturn something on the Supreme Court. It's not an easy thing to do. And they have poured tons of resources, and they've gotten very close to doing it. And that doesn't even look at all the legislative battles, the state legislative battles that they have fought, and for the most part won. So,
and it's not just money. They actually have popular forces.
Yeah. I mean, no, that's, yeah. I mean, you know, somebody's got to staff those phone banks. Somebody's got to make those phone calls and knock on doors. And the notion that they're not doing it once they get in power is, if you see any differential success on the economic versus the gender front, it's only because the feminist movement was actually much more successful in recent memory than the labor movement was. I mean, the labor's big victories, I mean, if you want to think of the economic issues as representing labor, were a long time ago. And they had been institutionalized, but they had grown, obviously, way weaker with time. So if the right was more successful on that front, it's not because that's what they cared more about. It's because that there was far less resistance on that front than, you know, the women's movement put up a huge fight.
And this is, you know, the same-sex marriage has been their more recent obsession.
Yes. Well, this is a, you know, as you know, Yasmin Nair, you know, we've talked quite a bit about this, and, you know, I've been thinking more about her position. I mean, she thinks that the triumph of same-sex marriage is actually the triumph of conservatism. Now, as an empirical fact, that's not true, because conservatives up until very recently, you know, were really staunchly opposed. But she makes, I think, a case that has to be dealt with, that the triumph of marriage as an issue is the privatization of benefits away from the state. There's something to that, you know,
that fits in neatly with the right wing worldview.
Exactly, you know,
and also it's a way of domesticating a once radical movement,
right?
That was very sexually disruptive,
right?
And then, right, you know.
She's definitely giving me food for thought on this. I mean, I would have, you know, probably before just seen this as just an extension of these battles. I think she complicates it in interesting ways.
We're listening to Corey Robin, Associate Professor of Political Science at Brooklyn College and author of The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Sarah Palin, just out in paperback from Oxford University Press. He also blogs at CoreyRobin.com. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
I was born in a welfare state, ruled by bureaucracy, controlled by civil servants and people dressed in grey. Got no privacy.
I was Son of 20th Century Man by the Kinks, which is one of the best songs in National Review's list of the 50 best conservative songs of all time. That list provoked a lot of outrage when it came out back in 2006 from left liberal types who were offended that conservatives were claiming bits of pop culture as their own, but there's no mistaking the conservatism of that song, or another from the Kinks we'll hear at the end of the show. Back to Corey Robin, Associate Professor of Political Science at Brooklyn College and author of The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Sarah Palin, just out in paperback from Oxford University Press. To switch gears, there's this longstanding tension I've seen in conservative thought between folks who revere a stable social order, some almost 18th century great chain of being model of society, against the marketeers who love the destabilizing power of the entrepreneur, who sound like Emersonian in their unsettling of all things, no past at my back, mm-hmm. endless seeker. How do you reconcile those things? Are they at all a contradiction?
They are. I mean, as you pose them, of course they're a contradiction.
What am I missing?
I think what happened with the right, beginning with Burke, is they began to understand that one of the reasons they were losing power and privilege is that the ruling class had grown flaccid and weak. It was too comfortable. And inheritance stood in for that comfortableness. And you see this very clearly in Burke by the end of his career. He's railing against the aristocratic ruling classes of Europe. He sounds Jacobin in his assault on them. And in multiple texts, whether it's Letter to a Noble Lord, the Letters on a Regicide Peace, and he begins to identify this problematic, forget the free market, that it just runs rife throughout the right from him onward, which is, if you're going to have a ruling class that's going to rule, there needs to be some kind of crucible, some kind of rite of passage for it by which it can develop the muscles of rule. That it can't be so flaccid and weak, because if it is, it just allows the masses to step forward and push past them. And throughout the 19th century, I think that for many on the right, the crucible of that was warfare. You see this very clearly in a figure like Nietzsche, for instance, that warfare, but you know, he's not the only one.
No, we saw it here in the days after 9/11.
Yeah, the neoconservatives, you know, very much this is how people like William Crystal, Francis Fukuyama in an earlier iteration, they all talk this way. What's his name? Kaplan, Robert Kaplan, yeah. You know. Warfare is this opportunity for a ruling class that has grown weak to prove itself. And when I first started writing about conservatism, I was very interested in that tension between, you know, and they oftentimes saw warfare as opposed to the free market, that the free market was too anodyne. It was the sphere of narrow-minded individualists who just cared about the bottom line. There was nothing glorious or heroic about it.
Well, you got, was it Buckley or Crystal to say there's nothing more boring than the free market?
Buckley, yeah. I mean, that's exactly what he said. And it fit in with this, you know, a lot of people have noticed that, you know, the tension between the virtues of kind of small R republicanism, the martial valor and glory and heroism, versus the virtues of commerce. Yeah. And in fact, Albert Hirschman, the economist, wrote a brilliant book about that tension. We called them the passions versus the interests. And the idea is that commerce would domesticate people essentially into becoming non-warriors. So that's, I think, the way I originally thought about it. But in part through the writing of this book and thinking about these issues and something I was alluding to earlier, I began to see that the free market could ultimately come to be seen as a kind of proving ground for a new ruling class, that this was an opportunity for people to recreate a ruling class almost with every generation, and that what would come out of that social ferment that you see in the market itself were people who were men, mostly, who were stronger, more astute, more acute in all these different ways, and that this would be a real ruling class. And so I think that is actually, the more I've read and thought about this and written about it, the more I think that in fact is the real story of the right. From Burke onwards, is the way they came to embrace the free market as the testing ground of a ruling class that could actually rule.
Speak with Corey Robin, whose book, The Reactionary Mind, is just out in paper from Oxford University Press. And also you've got a piece in the, it's so hard to date The Nation. which, you know,
it's coming out, I think, today. The day that this is going to be broadcast on the 9th of May, I think. It'll be out live on the web.
Yeah, but they'll probably like date it in July or something like that, right?
Yes. Yeah, I don't know what date.
May
27th, I think, is the actual date.
May 27th, yes. Okay. We can live in the future reading The Nation. A piece about Nietzsche and the influence or affinities between him and people like Hayek and the other Austrians, which might strike some people as odd on first view, but you make a very convincing case. So what is it that ties these spirits together?
Well, it's the piece is called Nietzsche's Marginal Children, and there's an interesting chronological coincidence that I noticed, which is that Nietzsche's first great text, The Birth of Tragedy, his first real text, is being written and comes out almost exactly to the year that Stanley Jevons publishes his Theory of Political Economy, and Karl Menger publishes his Principles of Economics. And these are two of the three founders of what's called the Marginal Revolution. And Nietzsche is, as you know, he's not oftentimes thought of in the company of these economists. I mean, he hated economists, and he hated economics, and he hated capitalism. But there's an underlying elective affinity, you might say, in his theory, and what's going on in the development of neoclassical economics. There's a couple of them. First is both groups loathe the socialist movement and trade unions in particular. So there's a political commonality there, but I think it goes deeper than that, which is that partially what Nietzsche does in the sphere questions of value. He's the great questioner about the foundation of values, and he's speaking particularly of moral values, not at all of what we think of as value in economics. But he basically says
it's the same word in German, Wert, right?
I think so. Yeah, but that value actually has no objective foundation. It has no grounding in anything in the world. It is merely the ascription that we put on the things of this world. We create values. And Nietzsche, again, as I said, is mostly, almost solely and exclusively interested in moral values, although he did have an extensive interest in economics. I mean, we should say this. I mean, he did read a lot about it. One of his texts, somebody's talking about Marx, and supposedly he underlined the name Marx something like 6 or 7 times. I mean, Marx was not really...
Not approvingly, I guess.
No, not at all. But he's aware of the labor theory of value as well, and very aware of the labor question. In fact, one of the last things he writes is a little section in Twilight of the Idols where he says, nothing has made us more stupid than the labor question. About certain things, one should not ask questions. And for him, the rise of the working classes, these were forces that, really just should be kept in the back. They should be hidden, literally hidden, behind walls, and they shouldn't be talked about, and they should certainly not be dominating public discussion. And of course, that's exactly what they were doing at the time.
And to be fair, Keynes had a great distaste for the working class, too.
He did. I mean, no, there's a lot of... Keynes has certainly, there's always been this Nietzschean dimension to the whole Bloomsbury crowd, actually. But anyway, so this is what Nietzsche's problematic, as it were, and was trying to find a way of creating a new nobility and aristocracy that would essentially create new values. And that was, that was his project. If you look at the development of...
And like a reactionary, he was contemptuous of the actually existing...
Ruling classes.
Elite.
Loathed them. Yeah. Which is why people always say he's not really a conservative, because he hated the ruling classes. But, as I've tried to argue, that's the hallmark of the conservatives. They always hate the ruling classes. They think they're weak and ineffective. And Nietzsche is the great diagnostician of that in the 19th century. So what you have is that's going on, and then you have these marginalists, and then their successors, particularly in the Austrian school in Vienna, Ludwig von Mises, Friedrich von Hayek, Friedrich Wieser, and Joseph Schumpeter, this whole sort of group of them, and they develop a lot. And what my basic argument is that not that they're influenced by Nietzsche, I don't think there's much evidence for that, but that they take that problematic. And what they do is they find, against what Nietzsche said, they basically believe that the economy can become this realm of aristocratic value creation.
You point out that Schumpeter uses a lot of martial language.
Yes.
The entrepreneur is a general, and competition is war.
Right. And Schumpeter, I should say, did read Nietzsche, and there's some people who have argued that he was actually quite influenced by Nietzsche. I mean, he really takes seriously the whole theory of the mass, versus the elite. And yeah, I mean, the entrepreneur is, it's hard to read, I mean, once you think about this connection, it's hard to read the entrepreneur as anything but this kind of overman, the superman, who is the smasher of idols and the creator of new forms of existence.
The heroic quester of romantic poetry.
Yeah, yeah. And really does do that in the way Schumpeter talks. And of course, the entrepreneur goes on to have this afterlife in right-wing economic circles. Ayn Rand was very big on the entrepreneur. They, you know, a lot of these guys, they hate, I think you asked me about this the last time we talked, you know, they hate corporations. They hate, you know, the middle management and the they just see it as a kind of another bureaucratic, constraining, stifling force. But they do love this entrepreneur. This,
I hate to pick on Tom Frank, but again, he was doubted or made fun of, the business ideologists' love of revolution and the way they referred to the entrepreneur as revolutionary.
Uh-huh.
But there really is something to that in this kind of neo-capitalist ideology.
Yeah, I mean, it's very front and center. I mean, I would, at this point, I don't want to say to what extent it actually influences the actual policies. I mean, I know less about that. But in terms of the actual ideology, it's very important to it.
But the business press loves that stuff.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And it's huge. And, you know, we're talking about Joseph Schumpeter here. We're not exactly a lightweight of, you know, the history of economic thought. So that's in Schumpeter. In Hayek, I think it's even more interesting, and this is something that's really received very little attention, and it's right there in the Constitution of Liberty, and almost nobody's ever talked about it, which is that he imagines these men of leisure and men of capital, both, who will use their largesse, their financial largesse, to also create new values, not just new commodity, the production of new commodities, which some people have talked about that. So he makes a big deal. So, for instance, silk stockings, you know, which used to be this very elite privilege, and then suddenly it becomes this mass commodity form that's produced. And he sees the aristocracy and these men of leisure being very important to that. But it's also, as he says, the creation of new belief systems, the creation of new tastes, which is a very Nietzschean idea that it's not just values, it's actually tastes that matter. That's how you really express.
This sounds like Steve Jobs.
It does. I mean, and I've been doing a series of blog posts over the last 6 months, which drives everybody crazy, where I just take these little snippets from Hayek and I find something either in Nietzsche or something in the contemporary business press. And I think I did one actually on Steve Jobs. There was a quote.
He's contemptuous of market research because the public doesn't know what it wants.
Yeah, and he will.
But he knew.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the point about that, I mean, part it's the sort of elitism of it. But the other thing is that, you know, Nietzsche thought there was what he called great politics, große Politik. And this is heroic, you know, the will of the legislator, the founder of a new polity. It's a very Machiavellian idea. You know, the person who creates a new kind of political world and puts his stamp upon the world. And the conclusion he reached was, you know, the age of great politics is over. And in fact, it's been done in by these economists. Because if you're, you know, a self-interested utility maximizer, who's often risk averse, you know, the last thing you're going to do is try to do anything as magnificent as create a new world, a new state. And one of the sort of the subtle or the subterranean arguments of this piece is that fascism was one political attempt to realize that vision, to say, well, no, in fact, we can create a new political world, and that's what this new fascist man will be. And fascism was ultimately an unsuccessful project. It's defeated. My argument is that the Austrians, and particularly Hayek and von Mises, the genius of what they did, I think, is to say, no, in fact, you could do this in the economic realm. You shouldn't do it in the conventionally defined political realm. Do it in the economic realm. You will create these new empires. And these new tastes.
And then when Thatcher said we want to change the soul.
Yeah, that's exactly.
She was drawing on that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, she was a big follower of Hayek. And so, you know, I think that that's where I want to really ultimately go with this, and I only allude to this, is that I think that's, to my mind, has been the heart of the neoliberal project, has been the attempt to recreate aristocratic, elite forms of value and action, but concentrated in the economic realm.
But they're also contemptuous of, or many of the neoliberals, Gilder, and was very contemptuous of inherited wealth.
Yes. And, you know, that fits in with this idea of...
But Hayek was okay with inherited wealth.
Hayek was actually okay with, it was more than okay. He thought inherited wealth was a kind of form of natural selection, basically. I mean, he says it, that, you know, you don't really necessarily want to recreate a ruling class with every generation, because it's going to have to learn everything that those, you know, ineffable generations learned through the accumulation of their estate and passed on to their children, to their sons. So he is actually a little bit more old school in that regard.
I was amazed to learn that he wanted to rehabilitate the idle rich.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
You because know. It's funny, our rich today are very busy telling us how much they work.
Yeah, no, they're the exact opposite. I mean, and in fairness, I mean, that was one thing he was worried about with the triumph of capitalism, was that the kind of economic classes who would come to fruition would be people who spent all their time working. And like Nietzsche, who was a huge critic of work and the domination of work over idleness and leisure, Hayek was nervous. He thought that cultural values would really suffer. And, you know, he writes that in 1960, and he says, you know, the problem with all of our ruling classes today is, you know, they can't really rule because all they can do is make money. And, you know, he's writing at the high tide of the welfare state and very nervous about the future of these capitalist classes. He turns out he need not have worried because, in part, because of books like his, you get the emergence of a real, genuine political class that understands its task as the reversal of all this stuff.
And a lot of people find Hayek and Friedman, who we haven't talked about, their fondness for Augusto Pinochet a little hard to understand. But it's not hard to understand for you at all.
No, not at all. I mean, Hayek, I mean, first of all, he says, I mean, there was a great piece that came out, the Journal of Economics and Sociology last summer with these three economists, I think at Dickinson College, and I blogged about it at the time, where they had uncovered all this archival information about Hayek's involvement with Pinochet, that it wasn't just, you know, a doddering old man who didn't know what he was doing. He was actively involved, and he helped. It was from the ground up. One of the things I discovered in following up on this article, he helped organize a meeting of the Mont Pelerin Society in Viña del Mar and in Chile, and he was very active in that process of shaping it. So he was very active in it, but you don't even have to event in the end. You don't really have to go to the archival information. Just the constitutional liberty. There are moments in there where he talks about the need for a kind of strong man to come in and create the rules that will allow a market society to emerge. And you know, there's some nod that this could be an authoritarian type figure. And in fact, he sends the constitutional liberty, sends a copy of it the following year to Salazar, who is the Portuguese dictator, authoritarian dictator. What's interesting about that in particular is that when he elsewhere where he talks about laws and rules, he always talks about them as the slow accumulated evolutionary wisdom of the ages. It's a slightly Burkean twist about law. But in these moments, he sounds like a devotee of Carl Schmitt, with whom he had a running dialogue, actually, and you mentioned Schmitt in the Constitutional Liberty. And by that, I mean, you know, Schmitt was a believer. His claim to fame was these, what he calls, you know, the moments of exception, where, you know, you just create a kind of, where a society's in free fall and there's no rules to go by, and you create the rule.
It's a revolutionary moment.
Yeah, exactly.
Which brings us in conclusion to the libertarians and, you know, the right in general conception of freedom and liberty. They love to talk about liberty. We love that word when I was in the party of the right, more than freedom. I'm not quite sure why. But they have a very special definition of liberty. It's not for everyone.
No, I mean, in Hayek, I mean, it's the one I look at in here. And again, very little attention has been paid to this. And you don't have to dig. This is right there in the text, where he basically says that, you know, people oftentimes think that Hayek is some kind of Nozickian. He's a defender of natural rights. Nothing could be further from the truth. He doesn't believe in natural rights. The value of freedom is that it enables progress. However, it's a consequentialist argument. It's not a foundational argument. It's that the consequences of freedom are great and everybody will benefit from it. But what he makes very clear is that, freedom, that there are certain individuals who are better placed and more talented, essentially, who will make better use of freedom. And that's the person whose freedom we ought to care about most. He says, it's not your freedom that you should care, my freedom. That's not whose freedom I should care about. I should care about the freedom of that superior man who is going to take all the little dispersed bits of knowledge and information that are out there and create something new. A new way of living, a new way of being that we'll all benefit from. And he says, the fact of the matter is we don't know who that man is. So we can't just reserve freedom for a couple of few people. it has to be extended to everybody. But that's it's a second-rate concession. And the implication is, well, if we knew who it was, and if we had a way of figuring that out, well, then we should only give freedom to that person and everybody else can be drones. But we can't know in advance, so therefore we have to give it to everybody. But it's that person is the one whose freedom is the most valuable.
But he would not like to create a social order in which the freedom of the many were supported.
Not at all. And in fact, I mean, he has a lengthy discussion about workers. And, you know, he basically says, you know, the condition of happiness and well-being of the worker is to obey a superior.
The way they're constructed. Like it that way.
They like it that way. It's not merely, at moments he says, well, you know, of course, if you're a worker, you don't have much room for space for creativity and opportunity. But he goes beyond that. He says, no, in fact, there's something about their nature. They like that paycheck. Not just the paycheck and not just the security. They like doing rote jobs because they don't want to tax their imagination very much. And if you read Nietzsche he has sections in Human, All Too Human, on culture and caste. I mean, he basically says a ruling class, the reason it shouldn't work is that it suffers more than everybody else. And by that he means the ruling class is more attuned to all the forms of social existence that are out there, and it feels it much more deeply and can therefore create culture out of that and should be left alone because it suffers so much. And again, by that he means just it sees things and feels things that nobody else feels. And that's very similar exactly to how Hayek talks about the men of the workers versus the capitalist. The capitalist is, you know, he sees things that nobody else sees.
On last week's show, Mark Blythe quoted that wonderful passage from Adam Smith where he says that for every rich man there must be 500 poor. And that rich man is the one who we really have to cultivate and assure his freedom.
Yeah, although I would actually say Smith is probably much more of an egalitarian than Hayek was, I mean, oddly enough. You know, Hayek is writing 150 years later when, you know, these movements have been on the march. And, you know, he's much more sensitive about the need to defend the wealth of the rich than Smith was. It wasn't as much of a vital political question in his day.
They're just a little baby then. All right, thanks, Corey.
Sure, thanks.
That was Corey Robin, Associate Professor of Political Science at Brooklyn College and author of The Reactionary Mind, just out in paperback from Oxford. He blogs at coreyrobin.com. You can find his essay on the Nietzschean cast of economists like Jevons and Hayek in the May 27 issue of The Nation, which is also available on the magazine's website, thenation.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more Kinks, this an anti-union ditty called Back Into Line. It made the sequel to National Review's 50 Best Conservative Songs, the second best 50, I guess. Till next week, bye.